is the moment where Michael Sam got the news that he is going to be a member of the St. Louis Rams. There you see him on the phone, and there you see the raw emotion. We've seen this so many times, over and over again, for so many players.
It's not an unusual sight to see a football player break down after being drafted into the NFL, but what is unusual? An openly gay player being drafted and then kissing his boyfriend on national television. Joining us to talk about this historic event is Sid Ziegler. He's co-founder of Outsports.com. Hi, Sid.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, for those of us who didn't watch this moment live, tell us what happened and give us a background on Michael Sam being drafted.
Well, it was pretty compelling television. In the seventh round of the NFL draft, usually the only people watching are diehard NFL fans. But this year, because Michael Sam was there and still undrafted, it had a general public interest about it. Gay bars across the country were showing the NFL draft when straight bars weren't even showing the NFL draft. So it was compelling because we just didn't, at that late in the draft, know if Michael was going to be drafted at all, whether the story an hour later was going to be that the NFL is now welcoming gay players or that they were continuing to reject gay players. And luckily, the story was positive.
Right, because this was a seventh round. He was the, 249th player picked?
He was the seventh or eighth to last player selected, so it got close.
And I understand you were actually in the middle of writing a column excoriating the NFL for not drafting him?
No, it actually wasn't excoriating the NFL. It was about how the LGBT community and the NFL both lost. That's how it felt. It felt like it was going to be a defeat for both communities. The NFL wanted Michael Sam to get drafted. I know that for a fact, and they are thrilled that one of the 32 member teams decided to do it.
Why did the NFL want him to be drafted?
Because people who work with the NFL, and I have for many years, know it's just not this homophobic place that people paint it to be. And people there have gay family members. The commissioner, Roger Goodell, has a gay brother, and they have gay friends, and they have gay employees. And they wanted the truth to come out about what the NFL is, that it's a meritocracy and everyone is welcome. And if he hadn't gotten drafted, the story we would be talking about right now would be the continued homophobia of the NFL. They did not want that story to dominate the draft.
And he, when he was drafted, we just heard him. He was very emotional. He was crying. And then he kissed his boyfriend on TV, and there was cake in people's mouths and going back and forth. And it was quite a moment, and it was played over and over again. What did you make of that?
It was powerful. I thought that being broadcast into American living rooms was maybe just as powerful as him being drafted at all. I mean, people saw, a lot of people for the first time, two men kissing on the lips several times. And I know that there's been a lot of reaction about how terrible that was and children shouldn't have to see that. But at the end of the day, it was just two people sharing a moment together. And whether people want to believe it or not, gay people are real and aren't going anywhere.
But what about the fact that it was played over and over again? There was a tweet posted on the blog Deadspin that said, "I don't have a problem with Sam being gay. Be gay. I have a problem with ESPN showing Sam kissing his BF 5,492 times."
I'm thrilled they did. I'm so, because it just forces this conversation. People have wanted to ignore the plight of gay people and particularly gay athletes for a long, long time. And that image just made it front and center. We wouldn't be talking about Michael Sam as much as we are today if ESPN had not done that, if they hadn't shown people over and over and over again two men kissing. And I'm thrilled that they did. I understand the other perspective, but I'm just glad they did, and I hope they keep doing it.
Is it possible, though, that this alienated some fans who were rooting for him, who were like, okay, it's fine, but I don't want it, shoved in my face kind of thing.
No, I don't think any reasonable person would suddenly not support Michael Sam anymore because ESPN made a corporate decision to show this video over and over again. I mean, certainly there are unreasonable people and there are people who don't like Michael Sam for who he is, and they're going to use every excuse they can find to not support him. But reasonable people are not going to suddenly dislike Michael Sam because he kissed his boyfriend and they saw it a few times.
And meanwhile, I understand his jersey is the number two most selling jersey right now.
Yeah. What's fascinating about this is Michael Sam's jersey has only been for sale for about 36 hours. The other top draftees, their jersey has been on sale for 4 days. Michael Sam has passed all of them except Johnny Manziel, who was the most famous player in the draft. He passed the number one draft pick, Jadeveon Clowney, other quarterbacks like Teddy Bridgewater. And, I mean, the NFL told me that a seventh-round pick being in the top five for jersey sales at any point right after the draft has never even come close to happening.
So I understand you've been talking with Michael Sam or communicating with him since this happened. And so how's he handling it?
He's handling it great. He took his boyfriend and his agents, and they went to Las Vegas the night he got drafted, and they went and celebrated for about 36 hours. This morning he arrived in St. Louis, and it's back to work. I mean, he has 3 or 4 months now where it's put up or shut up. He is not going to make the team because he's gay. He's not going to get kicked off the team. He's going to gay. It's all going to depend on how he performs in practice and in those preseason games. So it's going to be an exciting time.
Sid Ziegler, co-founder of Outsports.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, what did you think of Michael Sam's PDA? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can join the conversation on Facebook, KCRW's Press Play. $32 million people tuned in to watch the first round of the draft this year. That is a record number. And Sunday Night Football has been a bright spot for NBC, sometimes the only bright spot in a schedule of flops over the past few years. But this year will be different, or at least NBC would have you believe that, as the network pitches its fall schedule today. That's right, it is upfront time, where the networks trot out the hot new properties coming this fall for advertisers. Michael Schneider is the Los Angeles Bureau Chief for TV Guide, co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff, and instead of joining me here in studio, he is there, right there, witnessing this phenomenon of the upfronts. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Madeline, how you doing?
Good, thanks. Well, you went to the NBC upfronts today, and what's your overall takeaway?
Well, they're celebrating for the first time in a long time. This is a much more happier NBC than we've seen in a while, thanks to the fact that they ended the year number one in the demo that everyone cares about, adults 18 to 49. But they also have a big new hit in the show, The Blacklist, which I don't know if you've been watching, but it's a solid show, and it does really well, especially when it comes time for DVR use. It gets huge bump from that, too. So this is a big show, and it's sort of the linchpin now of their big comeback story.
That's starring James Spader as a villain.
Yeah. It's he plays a great character, sort of a typical sort of anti-hero villain on the show, and it's a nice show, and it's sort of a sign of now where NBC's going.
And what is that sign?
Well, I think they're trying more shows in this vein, which sort of a mix of procedural, but also there's sort of a serialized element to it a lot of times with these sort of larger-than-life characters. But, they've got a number of those shows coming on. They're also rebuilding their comedy brand. Now, that's a portion of the schedule that they have still been struggling with. They've only got two shows coming back from last year, Parks and Recreation, which the critics love, I love, but not a lot of people watch, so it's coming back for 13 episodes final season. And then there's a new show called About a Boy, which is based on the movie and the book, which just launched a couple months ago, and they've got high hopes for it. They're bringing it back, but that's it for comedies coming back at NBC. So they've got their work cut out for them as they basically launch a whole new crop of comedy.
Right. And speaking of what's maybe on the way down, let's talk about the the musical shows, the competition shows like The Voice and American Idol. Let's hear a little clip from The Voice. This has been a huge hit for NBC.
We're very happy to officially announce that two music superstars will be joining the next season in these coaches' chairs. Pharrell Williams and Gwen Stefani will be added to The Voice family.
Okay, so that's a bright spot in an otherwise bleak picture for these kinds of singing competition shows, correct?
Yeah. Basically, The Voice is the only one that's still working, and partly it's because of those judges. They've managed to get superstars to go on the show, and people watch The Voice mostly for the judges, to tell you the truth. Probably less for the competition, but there's a lot of chemistry between Adam Levine and Blake Shelton. Now, as you heard, Pharrell and Gwen Stefani. Pharrell couldn't be hotter right now, and they managed to actually sign him to be a judge on this show. That's pretty amazing, and it's the flip side of the story with American Idol on Fox, which is struggling, really struggling, having its worst year yet, and it's coming back next year, but Fox just announced today they're going to really downsize it, whereas this year there were probably about 50 hours of American Idol. Next year there will only be about 37. They're going to keep it short and sweet and hope that maybe people will show up and watch a very streamlined, very fast-paced show.
All right, you mentioned Fox, and it seems like not a lot is working for them, except for the show that you just mentioned. Let's hear a clip from it, Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
I found a cold case of ours that everyone foolishly said was unsolvable. Case 52ABX-32QJ.
Jake, case 52ABX-32QJ is unsolvable.
Or maybe case 52ABX-32QJ is waiting for someone to de-unsolve it.
What's case 52ABX-32QJ?
Case 52ABX, we got to find a way to abbreviate this thing.
All right, that's Andy Samberg. And they're putting that in their once sacred Sunday night animation blocking where The Simpsons airs and Family Guy. Why are they doing that?
Yeah, they're breaking up the animation. You know, they've called it animation domination for years, but obviously they can't do it next year. They're doing it because, first off, these are shows that they really, Brooklyn Nine-Nine especially, won the Golden Globe last year. It's only in its first year. It's got a lot of promise, but it's not doing that well on Tuesday night. Fox was struggling with four comedies on Tuesday, so they've decided to basically break up their comedies. They have two that are more male-leaning in Brooklyn Nine-Nine and the new show Mulaney, which also comes from the mind of Lorne Michaels and sort of those folks. So those are going to be on Sunday nights behind the animated hits The Simpsons and Family Guy, figuring maybe they can continue to get some of the guys who are watching football earlier in the evening to stick around and watch those shows. And then on Tuesday night, they'll stick with the more female-driven comedies, New Girl and The Mindy Project. And hopefully maybe separating those four shows will strengthen all of them. That's at least the strategy.
Right, because The New Girl and The Mindy Project, those aren't doing so well?
No, but you know what? No comedy is doing really well except for the shows on CBS that are produced by Chuck Lorre, mostly The Big Bang Theory. Modern Family still does well on ABC, but so basically you've got Big Bang Theory, Modern Family, and then everything else. Comedy is still troubled.
Interesting. Well, what about broadcast TV in general? These upfronts don't include cable?
No, cable's already done most of theirs, although there are some cable networks that go this week as well, the bigger ones, so Turner, TBS, TNT, USA Network. They do go this week because they want to be seen as one of the big guys. They also want to get the same kind of ad rates that the big guys, the big broadcast networks do as well. But most of the cable networks go in the weeks and months beforehand. And a couple weeks ago, I think we were talking about the new fronts. Even the digital folks are getting in the swing of things as well.
Well, so what are people talking about there in terms of broadcast television trying to become a little bit more like the prestige cable?
Well, that's the sense is that, there's a lot of, Netflix envy is what I call it, is everyone's, trying to reinvent the system now that they see that, more talent is going to streaming video, more talent's going to cable, and broadcast networks been struggling to keep up. They're trying to change the model. They're trying to change the way they produce pilots, pick up pilots, spend money on these shows. They're also picking up a lot of shows this year. It's astounding the number of shows that they're picking up, most of which won't be on the air in the fall because there's just no room. But I think they're sort of trying to stick as much up against the wall as possible to see what will work. But, it's troubled time for broadcast networks. And honestly, walking around New York this week, going to the upfronts, you can't help but feel like this feels antiquated. This just is not the way people watch TV anymore. And I wonder how much longer we're still going to be doing this dog and pony show year after year.
Well, okay, this is just the beginning of the week. What do you expect for the rest of it?
I know. Don't I sound already jaded?
Yeah.
I've been here for a month. It's still early. We're still waiting on ABC and CBS. You know, they could be, you know, CBS, their big thing is they've got Thursday Night Football for the first time, which is sort of freaking all the other networks out. ABC and NBC and Fox are sort of playing it loose on Thursday because CBS is probably going to do very well with football because football does very well everywhere. So that's going to be a big game changer. And then the CW, which is the little network that could, it's turning into quite the little sci-fi network. They keep picking up more comic book shows and more sort of thriller shows and serialized shows, and they're interesting to watch, too.
All right, Michael, have fun in New York.
I will. I'll see you soon.
Okay, great. Michael Schneider is the LA Bureau Chief for TV Guide, and he's co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff. Coming up, what is happening in Ukraine? Last night's vote by some areas to secede is being called into question. The future for the entire country is looking more uncertain. That's next on Press Play.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and let's get a morning after read on what's happening in Ukraine. Separatists in Donetsk declared a victory in an independence vote held yesterday. Today, they declared their region of eastern Ukraine a sovereign state, the Donetsk People's Republic. And they asked Russia to annex their territory just as it annexed Crimea back in March. The Ukrainian president called Sunday's independence referendum a farce. Julia Yaffe is a Russia expert with the New Republic, and she joins us now. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so the Ukrainian president called the vote a farce. Is there any way to know what the true feelings are among the residents in Donetsk as to what they really want?
I mean, from where we sit on the other side of the ocean, it's really hard to tell. There's been such an intense information war being played by all sides, the Russian side, the American side, the Ukrainian side, that it's become really hard to tell what's going on. So on one hand, you have the rebels saying that 80-90% of the population in these places voted, and that 90% of those that voted for the independence of these people's republics. On the other hand, journalists who were on the ground went around with people who voted several times at each polling station. Some Russian journalists were offered to vote. They said, "Go ahead. Do you want to cast a ballot?" So, you know, anecdotally, it seems like it was not the most procedurally thorough vote, and it also seems like a lot of the people who opposed this and saw it as a farce just stayed home.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really hard to tell, and even talking to my colleagues in Moscow and in the region, they're having a hard time kind of sifting reality from the propaganda war on all sides.
Right. And so, but what does this mean the morning after this vote? What does it mean for that part of Ukraine, and what does it mean for the country as a whole?
I think we don't know yet. I think time will tell. It could mean that Russia could use this to say that that the presidential election being held on the 25th is illegitimate because these big parts of Ukraine have declared their independence, and so how can you have a presidential election there? But at the same time, you're seeing Russia act very differently than it has than it did when Crimea declared its independence. Where Russia, within a day, Crimea was part of the Russian Federation. Here, Russia seems to be kind of walking things back a little bit, not really sure what it wants to do here. Clearly, suddenly finding themselves in over their heads.
Mm-hmm.
What is Kiev going to be able to do? Can they, do they really see this as a farce, or do they see this as a splintering off? Will they be able to, the people in these regions do have legitimate grievances. The government in Kiev really did forget about them and didn't pay much attention to the things they, what they needed and the allaying the fears that they had after February's revolution. So mm-hmm. I think a lot of things are up in the air, and time will tell.
Yeah. Well, and we heard after the Crimean referendum that a lot of people in that region were Russian-speaking and aligned themselves. Mm-hmm. philosophically, I guess, more with Russia. Is that the same in this situation?
It doesn't seem to be the case in eastern and southeastern Ukraine. A lot of the polling by Russian pollsters, by Pew, the Pew Research Center also had a poll. It showed that the numbers were exactly flipped in the Pew poll for Crimea and southeastern Ukraine. Like a majority preferred a unified Ukraine rather than being independent or being part of Russia. And so, and other polls showed a support for this idea topping out at like 30%. So I think Russia knows that if it tries to absorb this region, it would have a huge problem on its hands financially, because it's an economically depressed region that needs a lot of support from Kiev, financial support from Kiev. You know, as Russia, with an economy that's officially now in recession, can it afford this? Can it afford new sanctions? I think Russia doesn't really know what to do, and I think Kiev doesn't either. So, mm-hmm. Which is dangerous, because when these two players, and America certainly, I don't think, knows what to do, and when these two, when all the three big players are kind of are confused like this, it can be kind of dangerous, because then the situation on the ground can play out in a number of different ways and take on a life of its own.
Russia had this vision for something called the Eurasian Project, and it included a free trade bloc, which would encompass Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. Is that now not the goal on the part of Vladimir Putin?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it's not the goal anymore, because he got, Belarus and Kazakhstan to show up, to sign up. He has pretty good relations with the Central Asian republics. He's never going to get the Baltics. He has good relations with the Armenians, who have signed on to this idea, at least in, at least in theory. So, this is kind of the problem, and this was the talk in Moscow, was that by getting Crimea, Putin lost Ukraine, which had always been a very close ally, in much the same way that he lost Georgia, which had also been a close ally before. So he tends to do these very short-sighted things that complicate things for him in the long run.
As you mentioned, there's an election coming up on May 25th. And what does that election look like now? Who are the front runners, and can we believe in the results?
Well, it's kind of the front runner now is Petro Poroshenko, who's a local oligarch, a local businessman, who was very active in the Euromaidan movement and was often on the stage and bankrolling a lot of it. He's leading former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko by double digits. The problem is that the problem that's always the problem in Ukraine, and as much as I think the Americans and the West want to side with Ukraine, this crisis has revealed the extent to which Ukraine is a pretty messed up country that's riddled with corruption and bad governance, that continues to plague the country. So what does it tell you that after this sweeping, that after this, a heady reform movement, the two leading candidates are a super corrupt former prime minister who, when she left office, was hated by Ukrainians, and an oligarch, which, in that part of the world, businessmen don't really engender a lot of trust, in part because a lot of times their gains have been ill-gotten. So, what does it tell you that after this revolutionary upswell and talk of reform, you still have the same types of actors running for president and winning.
Right, right. And Yanukovych apparently stole so much that the state was on the point of bankruptcy. What? Mm-hmm. Where is it now economically?
It's not doing too well, and the situation isn't helping. A lot of Western countries, including the U.S., have committed chunks of aid to Ukraine. The problem is Ukraine has gotten aid for you know, over a decade, if not longer, from the West, and doesn't really fix the systemic problems that cause it to be constantly on the brink of financial disaster. The other problem is all the trouble that Russia has fomented in the east and south of the country are distracting Kiev from, you know, for the rot in Kiev, the parliament in Kiev, from doing the things that it needs to do to reform the economy, to reform the political system, to get things moving. And so, you know, again, you're getting a former prime minister and a wealthy businessman vying, you know, for the two top spots, vying mm-hmm. for the top spot, and an economy that's not getting any better. This crisis, even though we see it changing from day to day, and people die here, people die there, troops move this way, rebels take this or that government building, but really it's just keeping Ukraine at a standstill economically and politically, and that's, I think, the most dangerous part of it.
Julia Yaffe, senior editor with The New Republic, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Roz Chast is here. The New Yorker cartoonist has a new memoir out. It's called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? It's a dark comedy about dealing with the end of her parents' lives. That after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The cartoons by Roz Chast are probably familiar to anyone who's picked up a New Yorker in the past 30 years. She's been drawing for the magazine since 1978. Her characters are usually filled with anxiety, insecurity, and guilt. Schlumpy people who somehow capture the internal angst we all feel. Roz Chast has a new graphic memoir out. It's called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? It keeps her humor while dealing with a serious subject, the end of her parents' lives. The book is funny, it's sad, and it's painfully honest. Roz Chast is here now. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Well, you're an only child, and your parents had you pretty late in life. Can you describe their relationship?
Sure. They were pretty much each other's everything. They didn't really date anybody besides each other. They knew each other since fifth grade, when my father was the fat boy in the back of the classroom. They grew up a couple of blocks apart from each other in East Harlem. They were born 10 days apart in 1912. And they married, I think they were about 26, when they were 26, and they were completely inseparable. They really were almost like one person. My mother used to say the rocks in his head match the holes in mine.
But they're so different the way you describe them in your book. He seems tentative. He's neurotic. He finds it difficult, as you draw, I mean, perhaps exaggerating, but difficult to make toast. And she is completely domineering.
Oh, absolutely. And that's not really an exaggeration. I mean, he found it very difficult to do just ordinary tasks. My mother was the one who changed light bulbs and drove, and he was very smart in a lot of ways. I mean, he spoke several languages, and he had a lot of poems that he had memorized from school. And he was a great guy, but my mother had much more of a sort of practical sense of how to get from A to B.
So there you are, finding yourself back in their apartment, what, some 40 years later after you'd left, and you had to deal with their decline. What was the most annoying thing to you when you first returned?
Oh, there were so many. I don't know, it was just an overwhelming amount of stuff to sort of deal with. And I think also knowing what would lie ahead, you know, you kind of get I kind of got the idea that things were not going to get better.
Mm-hmm.
And just sort of knowing that was hard in a certain way, that my visits were probably going to get more frequent and more, you know, involve more complicated things than just like stopping by to say hello.
Yeah.
And then going off back to my own life. I didn't live close to them. I was at that point, I was living, I mean, I still am. I'm living in Connecticut, and they lived in Brooklyn, and there was no other family to take care of them in Brooklyn.
So you reluctantly schlepped all the way down to Brooklyn and spent an increasing amount of time with them. And what I liked most about the book, aside from it being really funny in parts, is that you're really honest about how ambivalent you were about spending time with them.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I wish that I could have been, you know, a better person in a lot of ways. But I wanted to be honest about it. I didn't want to pretend that I was this vision of, you know, that I had of myself of, you know, before all of this started, of the perfect, you know, devoted daughter. And it was complicated. It took a long time to get out to their apartment, and I had children, and I had a job, and I had a husband, and I started to feel like I was being pulled in a lot of different directions. And my parents were difficult people in a lot of ways. It wasn't really always so great to spend time with them.
So your mom, at one point, she climbs up a stepladder to get something out of what you call, or you all called, the crazy closet.
Right. That was my mother's name for it. It was this room in the middle of the apartment. It was a small apartment. It was four rooms. But in the middle, the dead center of the apartment, was this closet that was an oversized closet that was sort of like our attic. And my parents, who had grown up poor and graduated from college into the Depression in 1932, had lifelong habits of frugality and never, ever throwing anything away. It was, my mother's rule was waste not, want not. So, you know, you didn't throw away an old suitcase just because it was tattered and the handle was coming off and the lining was, you know, in shreds, and you'd never use it again. You didn't throw it away because maybe you would use it for something somehow, sometime. So everything just went into this closet. This was a classic moment where, you know, there are so many things about being an adult child where, I mean, I can't remember exactly how old I was at the time. I was maybe like 50 or something like that. I was asked to go on for work to go to the Galapagos Islands with a friend of mine for a magazine. And I was going to do cartoons and do drawings of this trip, and she was going to write about it. And I mentioned it to my parents because I think even, you know, you repeat these habits of childhood. I like wanted to impress them in some mm-hmm. incredibly babyish, childish way. Like, look how well things are going for me. I'm going to the Galapagos Islands. And the minute I mentioned it, my mother said, Daddy and I went to the Galapagos Islands back in the 1970s. And when we crossed the equator, we got a certificate from King Neptune. and I know it's on top of the crazy closet. And the minute I heard this, I was like, don't look for that certificate, Mom. Don't climb up on the ladder and try to find the certificate. And of course she did. And of course she fell off the ladder. So you could say that this is all my fault.
So eventually, so that's the beginning of the end, the decline of both of your parents. And they eventually decide to move into an assisted living facility called, which you called The Place.
Yes,
and,
The Place.
And they, I mean, that's huge, right? They were living in this Brooklyn apartment for most of their lives, and then they have to leave it and move to a place where, The Place, where they know that it'll be their last place.
So horrible. I mean, it's just, there's no words for how sad it really is. And I did not know what else to do. They were at that point about 95, and they could not continue to live in that apartment. My father was leaving the stove on, which was really terrifying. My mother was falling more, and she would not use the life alert pendant because she was afraid they were going to take her to the hospital. And in the end, my mother fell somehow backwards into the bathtub, and my father couldn't get her out, and he was looking for somebody to help him in the building, and he got disoriented, and somebody had to bring him back to the apartment, and I think they started to realize this is not this is not going to get better. This is going to get worse. And we do have to eventually, maybe sooner rather than later, leave this apartment. And also, as I said, they did not have any relatives in Brooklyn. And I didn't feel comfortable just getting somebody, even if I had somebody living in their apartment with them full time, I wasn't living close enough to them to kind of check up on how things were going. And it made me nervous. It was like, what if that person got sick? Or what if that person were just not up to the task? I felt too far away to keep a good enough eye on things. So none of the solutions were good. None.
You didn't want them to live with you?
No, no. We don't have that gigantic of a house. And it just, I could not do it.
But it was very expensive.
Oh, yeah. Very, very expensive. But they, you know, they had scrimped and saved their entire lives. And so there was a sort of sad but also sort of black comedy aspect to this. You know, these are people who saved slivers of soap and, you know, all these habits of a lifetime. And to see it being spent so fast for nothing. I mean, it was something. It was to keep them comfortable and to keep them safe, but it wasn't something that, you know, they could have had more pleasure in their lives, mm-hmm. you know, but they denied themselves so much.
Your dad died first. And your mom died, what, about 2 years later?
About 2 years, yes.
Right. He was 95, she was 97.
That's right.
And at the end of her life, she told you about an event that happened when you were a little girl where she and you two were in a department store and you wandered away and you got lost. And, and she was so frightened that when you were reunited, she reacted by beating you.
Yeah.
Over and over again.
Yeah.
And that you hadn't remembered that.
I don't remember it.
You still don't remember it?
No. No, but I know that I was always afraid of her. Hmm. And I know she had a very fierce temper. But that, you know, it's also generational. It's her personality and it's also a generational thing, I think.
Yeah. But she also had all these fantasies and kind of strange memories that didn't exist. Do you believe that that happened?
I do. Yeah. I mean, she had told me about that before the stories. In some odd way, I do believe the department store story just because I know that that was what she was like. She really could get extremely angry.
How did you feel when she died? And did you still feel as apart from her? Or did you feel that in those last couple of years you got closer to her?
I wish I had gotten closer to her. You know, I was talking with somebody recently about this idea of closure. I don't know too many people who really, truly get that. I mean, maybe sometimes you do. I felt with my father when he died, I felt like it was okay. And not so much with my mother. She was very tough. And I tried to talk to her a little bit at the end about things, but I think it was too late, really. Mm. She didn't even seem to fully understand what I was looking for. And again, it may be a combination of her personality and a generational thing. She was just not, as one of the hospice ladies said, your mother is not a warm and cuddly person. And she wasn't, you know. She had many other strengths, but that was not who she was.
You write at the end that you keep your parents' cremains, as they're called.
Yes. Lovely word.
Yeah, it's a weird word. Their ashes in bags, separate bags, in your closet.
Yes.
Is that your crazy closet?
No, that's, we don't have a crazy closet in our house. They're in bags, which are in a box, which are in another box, which are in these drawstring bags that the funeral parlor gave me. My mother is in a bag within a box, within a box, within the maroon drawstring bag, and my father is within a bag, within a box, within a box, in a blue drawstring bag, which is inside of the Channel 13, the educational TV in New York station, this tote bag that he always carried with him. And mm-hmm. I have inside that bag his CB hat and his Phi Beta Kappa certificate. And these were things that were extremely meaningful to him. And I don't know if they're going to be in my closet forever, but right now I can't think of any place that I would prefer keeping them. That doesn't seem arbitrary.
Because you open up your closet every day?
Yes. And I think about them.
And you can shut the door.
And then I can shut the door.
Roz Chast is a New Yorker cartoonist, and her new book is called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? It's a graphic memoir. And Warren Olney is here now to give us a preview of what's happening at 1 o'clock on To the Point.
I don't know that it's an answer to Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant. It's all about politics in Washington and the Republicans finding Benghazi and the IRS as things that we all need to know more about. It's an interesting program. It's an interesting subject, and some very lively conversation will be had.
All right. We'll look forward to that. Coming up at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Olney. And coming up on this program, how to tell if you're too stoned to drive. There is no DUI standard like with alcohol, but it's probably on the way. That story coming up next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Last week, the California Assembly tried and failed to pass a law that would set legal limits for driving under the influence of pot and other drugs. Which doesn't mean you can get high and drive, but what it does mean is, well, it's unclear. And here to help us is criminal defense attorney Joel Corey, who's handled 500 cases?
Yes.
500 DUI cases.
Oh, at least.
At least. Okay, so for our conversation, let's focus on marijuana. And is there a legal limit?
No, currently under California law, there's no legal limit. But it is illegal to drive if you're impaired. What that means is that if your mental or physical abilities mean that you can't operate a vehicle as safely as a sober person, well, then you are breaking the law and you're guilty of driving under the influence.
And how do they determine that?
Well, it's somewhat subjective because what a police officer will do is they have to do an investigation. And they will look at a number of things. They'll look at your driving behavior. They'll look at your overall demeanor. And then they'll have you submit to a series of tests, these field sobriety tests, the same kind of tests that you see a person under the alcohol being subjected to, mm-hmm. walk the line, touch your nose, things of that sort. And then the last thing they do is they look to see if you have any THC in your blood system. And if you do, then that helps to corroborate the officer's opinion.
However, THC can be in your blood system for, what, up to 24 hours?
Or even longer. And the problem with that is you may have THC in your system even though there is absolutely no evidence of impairment. And therefore, a person could find themselves having to battle a DUI charge when the THC that's in their system has no impact whatsoever on their ability to drive a car safely.
Okay, so that's not on the table right now, measuring someone's THC. But police, as you say, can use other factors to determine whether or not someone's impaired.
Police can absolutely use whatever factors they find. For example, a police officer might pull someone over and smell marijuana in the car. That's immediately going to have a police officer have a person out doing a series of tests, answering a series of questions. And then the officer can impound your car, can arrest you, can take you back to the station, can demand that you submit to a blood sample. And if you refuse, then your license is suspended and there's a whole host of consequences that flow from that.
And if they see any kind of other evidence inside the car, like a marijuana card, for example?
Marijuana card could trigger an investigation. The remnants of the marijuana smell on your clothes from the night before could trigger an investigation.
So when these cases go before a judge, who is the judge likely to side with?
Well, it's a jury that ultimately is going to make the determination. And many times, juries will give a police officer a great deal of deference.
So are you seeing with more and more people getting marijuana cards and it becoming more accepted in California that these things are happening more often, that police are arresting more people for suspicion of driving under the influence of marijuana?
Not at the moment. Typically, police officers will restrict those kinds of investigations to where there's something obvious, like an accident. I think you are going to see more of it in the future as the proliferation of marijuana pot shops continues.
Compare, though, these diagnostic tools that the police have for determining impairment. Compare them, their effectiveness between alcohol and marijuana.
Well, alcohol is fairly obvious to most people. We've all seen someone under the influence of alcohol, and we all know the symptoms. A person has red bloodshot eyes, their speech is slurred, their balance is impaired. And police officers have become very astute at recognizing those symptoms and doing an investigation. The problem with marijuana is the signs are so much more subtle, and it's much more difficult. And because of that, I don't know where the legislation is going to go ultimately, but I think that they ultimately are going to go to a place where they are going to have to try and set some kind of threshold, whatever that threshold may be.
But as a criminal defense attorney, you can easily shoot holes in that argument, can't you? You can say this person maybe smoked pot 24 hours ago, like we just said, and wasn't impaired at the time.
As a criminal defense attorney, absolutely, I can shoot holes in that. The problem is that if you're the poor, unfortunate person that gets arrested, you have to hire a lawyer, you have to take time off work, you have to go to court, you have to go to the DMV, and you have to fight that battle, which is really an unpleasant experience for most people.
Okay, you say poor and unfortunate person. Maybe someone else would say this person is creating a public hazard.
Absolutely.
Shouldn't be behind the wheel.
Absolutely.
And this is a public safety issue.
And it may be to a certain extent. How we refine the law to make sure that we catch the people that we want is really going to be the challenge in the future. You know, the one thing about DUI laws, DUIs are just as prevalent in Beverly Hills as in Watts. But here's the difference. When a DUI occurs in Beverly Hills, that person is more likely to have the resources to be able to pay to defend themselves, to be able to pay the fines, which are then divided up among the courts, the law enforcement, the lawyers.
So the person who lives in Watts or the person who's poor doesn't have that access. And so is that person more likely to be convicted of a DUI?
That person is more likely to have difficulty. It's very complicated if you get arrested for a DUI because you have to deal with a labyrinth of procedures with the DMV. You have to deal with a labyrinth of procedures with the court, and they're separate and distinct. Now, there's very good public defenders. I was a public defender for 20 years. I know the quality of those lawyers, but those lawyers are not allowed to help a person with the DMV. And in this city, if you don't have a driver's license and you're not capable of driving, that's a pretty onerous burden to go through for 5 months, 6 months, a year. So it's a very difficult process.
How often do you think, and I know that you're on one side of this issue, but how often do you think that the police are wrong when they arrest someone and on suspicion of DUI, driving under the influence of marijuana?
I think currently police officers are fairly conservative about it. I really do. But they are conservative now. The problem that I see is with the proliferation of marijuana shops, I think we're going to see more and more arrests in the future.
And you think that some form of this legislation will be brought back?
Absolutely. How it's going to look ultimately, I don't know, but I do think it will be brought back at some point.
Well, I guess part of the problem is there's so much unknown as it is in terms of how THC impairs somebody, correct? If it impairs somebody.
And to what extent? And I agree with you, there is uncertainty now. But I think over time, we are going to see that the law will be refined. I think there will be more studies. I think there will be greater expertise by law enforcement officers. And I think ultimately we will reach somewhat of a workable solution. The way many of these laws are enacted and the way many of these limits are set is once research has been done and it's accepted widespread, the federal government often will dictate as a condition of getting highway funds that the blood alcohol limit has to be 0.08, for example. And then that will slowly create this tidal wave where state after state will start adopting standards that have been adopted by another state because the federal government says, well, that seems like a very good standard that's in place in Colorado. Why don't you consider imposing something as well?
Joel Corey, criminal defense attorney. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
All right, time to bring in Jolie Myers now, who has the mail.
Hello. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday.
I just wanted to point out that interviews like the Roz Chast interview should come with a tearjerker alert.
A box of Kleenex.
I know that there's so many people like crying into their tuna sandwiches out there right now, but that
well,
it was wonderful.
Well, if they're eating tuna sandwiches,
if they're
that's
eating.
Sad enough.
Yeah, maybe they're crying about that. Okay, well, congratulations are in order for Michael Sam, who's been drafted to the St. Louis Rams, and we talked about how he celebrated. He gave his boyfriend a big ol' smooch on live TV. And the reaction across the country was mixed, but we asked what you guys thought, the press players. And a lot of you thought it was a non-story. George Caballo says it's a shoulder shrug. What was Michael Sam supposed to do? Move on, people. Joey Boyd said the moment was perfect, sweet and adorable. Joey even made the kiss his profile picture, I noticed when I was looking at his comment. Mark Willis also left a comment on our Facebook page. He says, it's okay to punch or kick or shoot or stab or blow up a guy on TV, but kiss him? Gasp! So that's obviously sarcasm. Mm-hmm. He goes on to say, two men or two women kissing is reality. Get with it or shut up. Which is a ringing endorsement for Michael Sam. But Freddie Haft says he's just not into PDA. It doesn't matter if it's same sex or otherwise. He says it's okay to kiss your mother on TV, but that's it. Otherwise, you're just stirring the pot.
All right. If you have something to say, if you want to stir the pot, we welcome that. You can leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. You can weigh in on our Facebook page, as so many already have. KCRW's Press Play. We're also on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. I am at The Mad Brand, Jolie Myers. Thank you very much. And Warren Olney, To the Point. Up next, I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.